Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. My pleasure to welcome Barbara Eisenberg, who is a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times and Time Magazine. I'm sure you've seen many of her articles there. She's written for Esquire, Talk, and London Sunday Times. She received a Distinguished Artist Award from the Los Angeles Music Center. She's been a visiting scholar at the Getty Research Institute, and she is Associate Director of the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities at USC, where I have the honor of working with her. Her books include Making It Big, The Diary of a Broadway Musical, and State of the Arts, California Artists Talk About Their Work, a collection of more than 50 interviews with writers, painters, and sculptors, actors, musicians, photographers, ranging from Louis Valdez to Joan Didion, David Hockney, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Her new book, Conversations with Frank Gehry, will be published by Knopf in April and reflects her interviews with a celebrated architect over the past 20 years. It is a great pleasure to welcome Barbara Eisenberg to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Now, I'm going to tell you all about Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, our guest this evening. Sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is the Emily Hargroves Fisher Professor of Education at Harvard, where since 1972 she has studied the cultures of schools, families, and communities. A graduate of Swarthmore College, she did her graduate work at Harvard, where she received her doctorate in the sociology of education and was soon asked to become a member of the faculty. She did so when she was just 26. And she was the first African-American woman appointed to an endowed professorship at the school. And when she retires, the professorship will take on her name. For many years, she was also the only tenured African-American woman at Harvard. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot spent her teenage years in Pomona, New York, which she has described as apple orchard country northwest of Manhattan. Her mother was a child psychoanalyst and the subject of her daughter Sarah's 1984 book, Balm and Gilead, Journey of a Healer. She has referred to giving her mother, quote, a second analysis in that book, which won the 1988 Christopher Award for, quote, literary merit and humanitarian achievement. In 1984, she received the prestigious MacArthur Prize Fellowship, and several years later, she also served as chairman of the board of the MacArthur Foundation. In 1993, she was awarded Harvard's George Lilly Prize for research that makes, quote, the most valuable contribution to science and is to the benefit of mankind. In addition to her new book, she is the author of 8 other books. She has written about the relationship between parents and teachers, teachers and schools, schools and community, and in this book, The Culture of Aging Smartly and Purposefully. The third chapter, Passion, Risk, and Adventure in the 25 Years After 50, profiles 40 men and women who voluntarily or not wound up leaving their successful careers after age 50. Sorry, I should pause for the laugh. She talks with each of those 40 people about how and why they left, their fears and their dreams, their hopes actualized and unactualized, and really about what happens next. Providing such guidance for this third chapter is a huge issue today, with 10,000 baby boomers turning 60 every day. As many as 64 million baby boomers, over 40% of the U.S. workforce, will reach retirement age by the end of the decade. Thank heaven for Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot's book. She says, quote, "We must develop a compelling vision of a later life, one that does not assume a trajectory of decline after 50, but one that recognizes it as a time of change, growth, and new learning, a time when our courage gives us hope. She is here tonight to talk with us about that time of change and growth, courage and hope. Please join me now in welcoming Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot.
What a beautiful introduction.
Thank you. I'm a writer.
You sure are.
I'm a professional
You are.
Well, I always like to start at the beginning in an interview, and I think people like to know where a book comes from. So perhaps let's start with, where did this book come from? What led you to write it?
Well, as I think back over the past couple of decades, the first time I imagined thinking about these ideas that are expressed in this book, was when I was in my middle years, early middle years. My mother was then, I remember it clearly, 72 years old, and she is now 94 years old and going strong. And she called her three children, all of us in our early middle years, to the homestead, which is where we grew up, where she still lives. And she wanted to say, first of all, wanted to plan for the future, but she wanted to begin what we began to call the Homestead Summit, which we do every other year, by telling us who she was becoming, what she was curious about, what she feared, what she was dreaming about, what she wanted to learn, what she was fearful about. In other words, she wanted us to get current with who she was as a 72-year-old woman. And I remember feeling somewhat defensive, you know, when she said that, because I thought, here are her three children, all of us with big empathy quotients, you know, all of us who know how to listen to our mother when she tells stories. And also, I had spent 3 years writing a biography of my mother. I mean, gee whiz, going through this second analysis. But what she was saying was, first of all, that biography sort of took us through her early adulthood, about the time when her children arrived. And she was saying, I'm still growing, and I want my children, who are now adults, to know me as I am now. And so that began me thinking about this business of lifelong learning, of still becoming, of still being creative, of still wanting people to know the truth about who you are at the moment.
Well, then, okay, you have this notion that this is something you really want to explore. You then found 40 people to kind of talk about your ideas with them and through them.
Right.
Can you tell me how you did that? Where did your 40 people come from, and what did they have in common?
Right. Well, I should say that a more recent experience in the past several years has been going to any social event, any professional event, any conference, and sitting next to someone in their third chapter, someone between 50 and 75, who leans over into me and says, in what I began to call confessional tones, this is what I'm passionate about. This is what I'm beginning to do. This is what I'm learning. And they're much more excited about this than any answer to my question, which might be, what's your job or what's your work? And I began to wonder why these whispered tones, you know, why were they sort of reticent? Why were they shy? Why did they sort of seem to not want to be taken seriously? You know, and I began really pursuing this with people just sort of colloquially, just in general, as we sat around, and then began to say, I want to learn more about this, more deeply about this. And so I did this very scientific thing that sociologists do. It's called the snowball sample, which is you find someone who's interested in learning something new at this time, reinventing himself or herself, taking new adventures, taking new risks, moving into other arenas and domains, and you say, can I watch you learn this? Can I talk with you about this? Can I ask you impertinent questions? Will you let me see you in the process? So it was a process of talking and interviewing, of witnessing, of observing, of watching. And then after I had sort of talked to someone for a while, I would say at the end of that those conversations, I'd say, do you know anyone else who's doing something interesting, right? And I did that all across the country. And so I interviewed people who were learning about all kinds of things, learning to play the jazz piano, learning to be portrait painters, beginning to discover international relief work, right? Beginning to discover how to plant city gardens, all these kinds of things, as well as the sort of relational things, learning how to survive the death of a child, for example, learning how to move on after the death of a spouse, those kinds of things.
Well, so many of the things that you're talking about with essentially the boomer generation are things that it seems our parents weren't thinking about as much, or at least talking about as much. You know, they couldn't, I mean, all of our parents could have been like your mother, not discussing it ever.
Yeah.
But it seems that the people that I remember growing up were people who were saying, oh my God, only two more years, I'll be 65, I can retire,
yeah,
or I'm taking early retirement so I can play golf or I can travel or whatever. It seems like this generation is different.
Yeah.
And is that, was that something that kind of got you going on this?
Absolutely.
The difference of this generation?
Partly we're living longer, you know. So, and there's this great sort of arc of life that's changing. And as you said, you know, every day 10,000 boomers are becoming 60. So there's this great population bulge here. And in the third chapter, rather than imagining this is the last chapter, most of us are hoping, if we're lucky and if we're healthy, that this will be the penultimate chapter, that there's another one to come. So what do we do with this that's meaningful and that's productive? And I think most of us by this age, if we've been involved in playing a role in an institution, having a career or a job that's defined by a particular set of routines, we're ready to move, either leave that or at least leave more space for other things. And so we're moving on to beginning to think about how can we recast what it is we're doing? How can we reinvent ourselves in another mode? But I also think that one of the things that we know is from really lifespan research is that it isn't only the individual developmental trajectory, but it's sort of where we were at a certain point of history when we were that age. So that those of us who are now boomers were in the 60s thinking that we were changing the world. We were audacious. We were bodacious. We had a lot of bravado. We felt we made an impact. We were thinking we were leaving a legacy. We think we stopped the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
We thought we were involved in the women's movement and helping to shape it. We were involved in the civil rights struggle. And now we come to the place in our lives, in our 50s and 60s, and we are the same people, you know, in lots of ways. We still believe that we can make a difference. And now we come with a whole lot of experience, a whole lot of wisdom, a whole set of resources that we didn't have before, both material and emotional, to engage the world in a new kind of way.
Well, I very much like your notion of giving back by giving forward, and rather than my attempting to define what you were saying, I'd love it if you could just talk about that notion.
I talk about looking back and giving forward,
mm-hmm.
And most people talk about giving back, and that means that if they grew up and they were given unto, that by the time they get to a certain age, they very much want to give something to the next generation. And I say giving forward partly because I think that we need to figure out a way, we third chapter folks, of engaging in service, engaging in charity in the best meaning of that, a benevolence, a generosity, making change, being involved in social change in a way that's contemporary, in a way that will have our altruism sort of match the contemporary cultural context. And that requires, I think, that we look forward, that we give forward. It requires as well that we're in conversation and discourse with people who are younger than we are, with youth. In other words, I think that part of what needs to happen is a much more cross-generational pollination and exchange and communication. And we need to see ourselves as learning from them, and they need to see, hear our stories and learn from us as well. So the idea of looking at what I found is that many people, in deciding how they would give forward during this time, in fact found themselves looking back to their own families of origin, to those values that were supported and underscored and taught in their own families around issues of service, around issues of justice, around issues of respect. And they wanted to bring those values forward and give forward.
So now that they had the time, now, yes. The one thing that we should kind of talk about is obviously this book was written before the economy fell apart.
Yes.
So a lot of these things that you're talking about, that in terms of taking risks and all, I mean, people are already taking risks getting up in the morning. So I wondered how, I guess maybe if we can just talk about being in this age, in this time. Let's
right.
start with that, and then we'll go right. back to the emotional and the professional rewards.
Right. Well, I think one of the things I say about the folks that I talked to and listened to and witnessed in their own new learning was that they had a sense of perceived abundance in their life. They saw themselves as having choices. And I use the word perceived because these weren't rich people, by and large. Many of them, in fact, came from poor and working class backgrounds. But where they were now felt as if they had enough and maybe even plenty. Enough so that they could at least entertain the possibility of alternative choices in their lives. One of the things that I've experienced since this book was published, which is just a couple of weeks ago, was listening to folks call in on NPR radio stations. So maybe I've been on 8 NPR stations around the country, and I sit there in my study, which you can do now with cyberspace and technology, in what my grandmother would have called my dishables, which is, you know, my pajamas. And I talk to people in Dallas, and I talk to people in Denver, right? Talk to people in Maine. It's just fabulous. And the host of NPR, always these very smart people who have read my book and who ask penetrating and probing questions. And that's for the first half hour. And the second half hour, people call in. And I've done this before with other books, but I've never had this experience. People call in from all walks of life, from all over the country, and they start by saying these words, almost exactly. You're talking about me, they say. You're talking about me. And then they never ask me a question. Then they proceed to tell their story.
Yeah. Yeah.
They tell their story, and these are fascinating stories from a range of people. So here's a guy who was fired from his factory job, right? And devastated by being fired, loved to work with metal, knew very little about art, takes his some of his belongings from home with his wife to flea markets on Saturday to sell them so he can put food on the table. And he recognizes there are a bunch of artists there, and they're working with unusual materials, and they're making unusual things. And he begins to think, you know, I could do that. And he begins to think, what am I interested in? And he thinks, the last time I was really passionately involved in anything was when Jurassic Park came out. I love dinosaurs. I love the bigness, the awkwardness, the aggressiveness, the beauty of these creatures. And he begins to take the old metals from around his house, and he gets a soldering iron in exchange at one of these flea markets, and he begins to do his work. He's reporting to us at age 62 on the radio that now he considers himself an artist. He sells his art. He's going to have a show at a local gallery. I mean, so he has, out of this suffering, he has emerged creative. And there are ways in which lots of the people who call in tell about experiences of either trauma or just constraint, right? And something and their response to that as being something that's purposeful, that's productive, that's meaningful, that moves them forward.
Well, I thought another thing that was quite interesting was the notion of so many people returning to the things that they loved when they were children.
Yes.
There's a wonderful anecdote in the book about a lawyer who was a corporate lawyer and who had a photograph of himself as a child yes. playing in the dirt. And then went on, I'll finish telling the story, I'm half through, and went back and started gardening.
Right.
You know, and
This was just a beautiful story of a fancy schmancy lawyer in a very fancy corporate firm who by the age of 62 was really tired and of this work, really burned out. And one of the things I discover in doing the research for this book is that burned out does not mean working too hard. Burned out means bored, right? And teachers, in fact, I've understood that in schools as well, when they talk about being burned out, they're talking about being bored, redundancy, repetitiveness, not having any kind of new edge to their work. So this guy, when his corporate firm begins to merge with another, he makes a graceful exit and he leaves. He's been actually wanting to leave since he was 40. So this is 22 years of hanging in there for all kinds of reasons, for the status of it, for the money of it, for the health insurance, for all those kinds of things. And the last thing he packs up in his office is a picture of himself with his mother when he was 8 years old in North Carolina, and their faces are smudged with dirt. And they're in the garden, and this was his favorite thing to do growing up, was working in the garden with his mother's. Flowers in the front, vegetables in the back, and twirling up and down the rows of cucumber and corn when he was little, and then working with his mother in it when he got older. And he leaves the corporate law office, having packed this up, and he says, I'm ready for a costume change. And his costume changes into overalls, into big boots that he calls shit kickers. And he begins by kicking the shit out of that dirt, right? And gets involved in, first, very, very personal, gets involved in building a beautiful Japanese garden in front of his brownstone, and then begins to work in other gardens around the neighborhood, and finally finds himself hanging out at a large city Chinese garden near Chinatown, which is really being planted by other grandparents his age, all Chinese, who are working underneath their big, broad straw hats. And they can't speak any English. He can't speak any Chinese. And he begins to work with them. And it becomes his regular gig. And it's still true that, because this happened in Boston, that you can drive by this Chinese garden any old day and see this one tall white man looking like a corporate lawyer dressed in his overalls with a Red Sox hat on in the midst of all these relatively short Chinese folks, men and women, in their broad straw hats.
Well, how do you jumpstart all that? I mean, this man obviously had the initiative, you know, to follow his dream. A lot of people don't have that initiative. How do you kind of give them that kind of kickstart to do? Do you have a suggestion on that?
Well, I think a lot of people talk about talking to other people who are in their third chapters going through many of the same things. It's hard to brainstorm alone. It's much easier to begin to talk to people and have them sort of interview you. What have you been interested in? What turns you on? What sends you? When's the last time you've been excited? That kind of thing. It's also true that going back to school, at a community college, for example, I think community colleges are great places, partly because they are the places that are educating first-generation immigrants for the most part, but also they're the places where there is some cross-generational learning. There are young people and lots of older adults going back, and they're places that are relatively inexpensive where you can take a broad range of courses, or adult education centers where you can just decide to go and begin to try something new. Learn Spanish, or as a plumber who came to my house last week to fix my dishwasher said to me, without any prompting, I wasn't interviewing him, I didn't even know he was in his third chapter, he said, Sarah, guess what I'm doing? I said, what are you doing? He said, for a year, I've been taking cooking classes at the Boston Adult Education Center. He is Italian. He's married to an Italian woman. They are both working people, and she's a fabulous cook. His mother was a fabulous cook, and what he said to me was that a year ago he decided to take cooking classes with the idea that by Thanksgiving, he was going to take over the entire Thanksgiving meal, and he was going to cook it. And what he said was, and he was successful at this, but he went to the Adult Education Center, and he didn't really know what he wanted. He flipped through the catalog and thought, you know, I've always wanted to get in the kitchen. She's always had that space all to herself. And it was a yearning that he discovered there.
Well, it also seems that he had a wife who cooperated. And
well, I don't know that side of the story.
No. Well, actually, I don't either. I am guessing that she didn't say to him, out of here, please.
Yes.
So therefore, assuming that she cooperated, it also seemed to me in reading your book how important it was to have what you called scaffolding.
Yes.
Or kind of community or other resources which helped you. And I perhaps you could talk about that for a moment.
I called it scaffolding at one point. I also called it cherishing. Mm. That to be in relationship with someone or someones who support you in this new adventure, who say, go for it, you know, I'll be here. I want to hear the story. Call when you get back, you know, that kind of thing is very helpful, whether it's a lover or a spouse or a partner, whether it's your grown children. Many people talked about their children saying, Mom, go for it, right? Or whether it's just a group of friends who hold you well and are concerned about your own experiences and your own passions, that this is very helpful. But it's also true that some of those relationships are strained as one of us goes off to seek our new adventure, to reinvent ourselves, because after all, the relationship was founded on another set of sort of ideals or ideas or values or way or habits even together. One of the people who I talked to had a sort of a wonderful way of talking about this. He said, this is a guy in corporate business, and he said, as I row into shore towards home, I want to be home. I'm coming into shore. I'm rowing. I look over there, and my wife is paddling out to sea. Right? So what he was talking about was this sensation of having to figure out a way to trust that where she was going to be okay in their relationship. And not only okay, to figure out a way of wanting to hear her stories, her adventures, as she told them, you know, and wanting to support whatever she was about to do.
Well, if we put the economic concern aside, for instance, and we think about this period, it seems like it's a period where children are grown, your own parents are often deceased. So you do have that freedom that you've never really had before, assuming you've had that kind of traditional life.
Right.
So how does that freedom give you how do you make the most of that freedom?
Well, you know, it's interesting.
And is it freedom?
Well, that's,
you know, that's the question.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was going to say, that one of the things that I talk about is this twin sensation of loss and liberation. Because it is loss to leave the work where we feel we have some mastery, where we feel we know the rituals and the routines and the rules, where we may have some status and station, where we know the role we should play, where people sometimes listen to us, right? Where we're seen as the mentors and teachers. And to give that up, either because we choose to or because we're forced to, either way feels often like a terrible loss. And moving from that to experiencing it as liberation, this blank canvas, this open space, rather than being terrified about that open space, to figuring out a way to design it, to make it something real, to give it dimension and complexity, to pour one's passion into it. That's not an easy journey. And so people talk about it as coming in fits and starts. It's just not that one day where you say, okay, now I will go forth and do this. It's more one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. One of my favorite developmental psychologists, who many of you may have read, wrote in the 50s, and his name was Erik Erikson. And he was the first person to really talk about stages of life's development. And he talked about these stages as being points of crisis and tension, of the tension being between moving forward and being pulled back. And for third chapter people, which is the penultimate stage he talks about, the next to the last one, he talks about this as being a crisis between generativity and stagnation. And how that gets resolved, not necessarily one winning over the other, but how you manage that tension and that crisis has a lot to do with your ability to begin to experience this next reinvention as liberation.
Well, I was thinking about the notion of, at this time of our lives, we're told both to slow down, but on the other hand, there is a clock, and it is ticking fast, and so the urge, you know, is to speed up. So you have slowing down on one side, speeding up on the other. And I wonder sort of how one reconciles those two things.
Well, again, I think just like loss and liberation is a central paradox of this time, another one that I point to in the book is this paradox of a sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. The time, the clock is ticking, the time is running out, life is finite. Mm-hmm. I better get moving. If I'm going to make a difference, I better get moving if life is going to be purposeful and if I'm going to leave a mark here. And on the other hand, one of the great benefits of being in our third chapter is the feeling of patience.
For some people.
I'm saying it's a twin feeling. I mean, I think, at least the folks that I spoke to talked about this twin sensation of their being more patient than they had ever been ever in their lives before. And that was sort of mixed with the other thing, which I think at least I experience, and many of the people I talk to experience it with and feel proud about, is restraint, right? That we are beginning to know when not to do something, when not to pursue something, when to hold back, when to shut up, when to leave space, when to let the silence sit there, right? And so there, that patience and restraint on the one hand, and on the other hand, we are really wanting to get it done. And it is sort of living with those contradictions that I think third chapter people manage. We manage to live with those contradictions and embrace them if we're lucky.
Well, it seems that people who age successfully are people who also kind of grew up in nurturing households. You mentioned this in your book, and I have found it in the people I've written about, both in my last book about artists and in my current book about Frank Gehry. All of these people, even though it wasn't my plan to talk about their childhoods, mm-hmm. that's what we talked about most.
Right.
Because you could see each of them building the steps that would lead them to successful adulthood, and now, in this period, to successful aging.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Even if you say, I want to watch you learn what you're learning now, and I want to talk to you about it, mm-hmm. almost everyone has to begin at the beginning. Has to begin with their childhood and has to begin with those primal relationships that have left such a deep imprint. And sometimes I think it's obviously easier if those early relationships have been nourishing and supportive and encouraging, if parents have been cheerleaders, if they've stood behind you. But if they haven't, one of the things that I found is that people need to go back to those early wounds and somehow reconcile with those. I talk about healing those wounds as a way of moving forward. And one of the things that was most inspiring and fascinating and moving to me in talking to folks was sometimes just in the process of our conversation, they're telling me stories about their early childhood. They would discover that they really had wounds that they were unaware of.
Right.
They would start to tell a story that they thought was sort of a very positive story and discover, oh my God, that came from a sad and painful, anguishing place. And there was a wonderful African-American 63-year-old public health doctor who had spent all of his adult life since becoming a physician, most of it in West Africa, working on eradicating malaria. And he called himself a workaholic, and he was very, very committed to this work. And what he began by telling me was that he had begun to take voice lessons. And he was so excited about this. And that he was doing this at least once a week and enjoying it enormously. And I sort of said, wow, how did you get interested in taking voice lessons? And suddenly, after a pause, this great sadness came over his face and even tears in his eyes. And he said, you know, and it was clear that the story that wanted to be positive was suddenly turning into a sad and painful story. And he said, my favorite thing to do as a child was to sit in my mother's lap. I remember this when I was 6 years old, on Sundays, and listen to the Metropolitan Opera. And he would sit there, and he said, I loved two things. One, the sound of those resonant, deep, incredible voices, the drama, the passion, and just sitting in my mother's lap being held, listening to this beautiful thing. And he said, and I remember it at six, saying to his mother, Mom, I want to be an opera singer when I grow up. And his mother didn't say to him, no. She didn't put him down verbally. But he remembers that there was a sort of dismissiveness to her gaze, right? Her eyes said something to him. He said, I felt as if she was saying, that's for sissies. And he said, I never asked again. I never spoke about it again. But when he decided to take voice lessons and was telling me this story, this early wound came up. And he said, that's why I think in doing my lessons, although I'll never sound like a great opera star, this isn't what I'm about. It's a very private vigilance about being in touch with finally liberating myself to do what I wanted to do all along, which is to sing, to give voice. And the other thing he said finally was that somehow finding this voice allowed him to be a better doctor, right? That there was a way in which his feeling kind of as if finally I can express myself the way I want to, release that voice deep from my diaphragm, I'm able to be a more attentive, more nurturant doctor.
Well, something that I've noticed that I noticed also in your book is that grandparents are also important. I know you grew up at a family where there were three generations at the table.
Yep.
And even in interviewing all these artists, I found so many of these artists really were nurtured by their grandparents.
Right.
And how important it was to them to have this adult who wasn't quite as direct. You know, wasn't the person right there who was having to be the administrator, having to scold them or tell them what to do. The grandparent kind of gave them the freedom. And in reading your books, you know, I see you in all your books. You're very, very present in your books. Mm-hmm. She is. I mean, she almost stops and says, hey, read this part again. You know? You do. I mean, you really are a Greek chorus running through all your books. And the books also reflect sort of the period of your life. The book of the six portraits of African Americans, all in middle age.
Yeah.
You happen to write at about the same age.
Yes.
As those other, you know, other six people. And then this book too. The first line of your book, I think, was "I am 62."
Right.
I believe it was the second line of the book.
Yeah.
So I hear you as this Greek chorus when you're writing, and I wondered what your Greek chorus kind of voice was saying in this particular book. Was there something we, I felt you saying all the time, come on, come on, get moving, think about it. Don't let these years go by without being generative.
Yes. It's true that I'm always writing about those things which I'm puzzling over, struggling over, questioning myself about. And I think all of us do, but rarely do academics and social scientists admit to it. Because we're supposed to come from some objective, place. And I think that it was that for sure, I am constantly reflecting myself on what's the next thing that I'm deeply curious about, that I want to know more about. I would think that the most important sort of quality of all of these people was their curiosity.
Right.
And it's something which I talk about as a quality that so often gets stomped out by schools, by our schooling, whether it's elementary school, junior, senior high school, graduate training, that we stop asking the primal questions that all kids ask, which is, so then what happened? So how did that happen? So what did he say? Any kid will ask that question. And so one of the things which I find about my own life is that when I stop being curious, it feels fallow, it feels empty, and I begin to worry. And it's up to me. If the Greek chorus is saying anything, it's saying, so what's next? What's the next question?
That is a good question. What is next? What are you curious about right now?
Well, I don't know what's next. And the way my rhythm with doing this work is that each book is this response to a burning question inside of me, and then I spend a lot of time not knowing the answer. Honest to goodness, really expecting surprises, expecting to learn something new, and then I write the book, and then. The next stage is wanting to get it out into conversation, larger public conversation. And I spend my energies doing that. And then for me, there is always this period in which I say, I don't have any ideas. And I get nervous and I get anxious about that. And I want to force something. And then I keep talking back to myself saying, this is the way it always is, Sarah. Cool out, cool down. And then at some point, it emerges, the next idea. But I don't have a kind of agenda of the next three books at all.
I was going to say not the next three.
The next.
I was thinking about the next research article.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants... I think it's very daunting to think about the next big project.
Yes.
It's sort of like with any big project, you want to take it in steps so that it isn't quite so daunting.
Right.
So I was sort of thinking what you might be interested in just this moment. It seems to me, from hearing you speak about the experience of talking to other people on the radio, they're probably all stimulating ideas which will come to fruition at some later time.
Right.
So, I feel what I should do is open the floor to questions, since I know that we do that here. And if you have a question, please raise your hand and Libby will bring you a microphone. And then I will call on them. Okay, I'll call on this person in the front row with his hand up.
Without going too far beyond what you're talking about already, was there any unanimity of perception among your interview subjects of what might constitute the fourth chapter? What is successful aging?
Well, I didn't have them as they were sort of living so deeply in the existential present. I didn't have them anticipating what the fourth stage would be. I do know that stopping it at 75, as I did, is sort of just arbitrary, right? Because there are a lot of people who think of themselves well into their 70s and even into their 80s as still engaged in these sorts of things that I was talking about. So as with any developmental period, it's sort of arbitrary, these 25 years. But I think I would imagine having watched some fairly successful fourth chapter people very up close, which is that the whole thing is to continue learning, to continue discovering, to continue asking the hard questions, and I think to continue as much as you can giving forward, right? Serving others, moving out of yourself and into the world. And those people who do that seem to not only stay alive longer, but live a life that's much richer. Someone over there?
This woman?
Sarah, have you found any people who failed to make that third chapter transition, and was there something to be learned from their failures?
Well, it's a wonderful question. I, in fact, was talking to people who were making the transition, who were learning something new. So that in some ways, I saw many people struggle, but I wouldn't say that I saw failures along the way. As a matter of fact, one of the things that is so universal, at least across these people, is the way that they learned from failure. That failure was the best diagnosis for learning how they learn. And again, this was something that one of the folks said to me, he had to unlearn old school habits, where he said, I used to hide failure in school in order to be an achieving, successful student. And now I realized he was turning from being an industrial engineer to becoming a sculptor. And he was realizing that in the studio in which he works, his failures were very public. And not only that, he had to ask for help. And he had to assume that people would give help that would be helpful, right? Rather than, that's not what you necessarily assume in school, right? Or most of it, or in the rough, tough world of living our lives through work. So I think I saw lots of failure, but lots of recovery and learning from failure. I think there's only one person who was trying to learn actually how to write about her life in Shanghai. I mean, she was trying to become a biographer, and she had been an organizational behavior kind of guru type. And she was she talked about experiencing, she was 75, and she was talking about how hard this was to learn to do, and the emptiness in her at not being able to accomplish this fast enough. And she's kept on saying to me, I feel hollow. I mean, it was felt as in her body. This was felt. And I think that was the only one who was almost ready to declare defeat when she began to sort of move past her failure and her fear. That's another thing. Her fear of looking foolish.
Well, couldn't she have felt hollow at 40 or at 25 or something like that?
But work and children and life filled her up. This was the business of this blank slate feeling terrifying and not knowing what to do with it. So she had not, in her own life, at least this woman, who was a very ambitious and aggressive and successful in her professional life, had never had the opportunity to feel hollow at all. Life had been so full. As a matter of fact, over full is one of the ways she described it.
Louise? I know we were putting economics aside, but to bring them back into the picture for a moment, I remember when Bill McKibben was here some time ago, he talked about how much creativity would be freed up in this country if we had health care. And it seems to me that you talked about the gentleman who stayed with his job for all the different reasons, but wouldn't that make a huge difference in people being able to make this transition? Because at the present time, people are launched out into the world either through no choice of their own, through a layoff or whatever, or the fear that, how do you survive in our society without adequate health care? It seems so basic to helping people make this transition a creative part of our lives. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. If the, you know, if you could choose kind of one thing that people that kept people in their jobs when they wanted to go, and when in lots of other ways they were ready to go, it was this concern for healthcare, and particularly in our third chapters. I mean, we're much more vulnerable. And the other thing that, of course, happens in our third chapters is you go to events and people begin to sort of engage in what one of my friends calls organ recitals, you know. and they talk about their lower back problems, and they talk about their receding hairline, and they talk about all these things. And one of the things that these people all talked about cutting through was, in some ways, deciding within themselves they weren't going to be captured by this preoccupation with the, you know, with what is inevitably a deterioration of our various organs. But on the other hand, they weren't willing to sort of put themselves out there and completely ignore the fact that we do need to feel safe, and we need to feel comfortable that we won't be stranded without health care. I think that's absolutely right.
This gentleman here in the with his hand up, reaching for the mic.
Yes, I noticed in the intro and also the biography that you were involved with MacArthur Foundation. I'm wondering how the profile of a typical genius compares to the more normal people that we were talking about today. Do they just achieve more sooner, or are they more driven, they're more focused, or what is the, what distinguishes the genius from the man in the street?
Well, you know, if you see me sort of getting red and blushing, it's because those of us who have gotten these prizes and are lucky to have this manna from heaven, absolutely reject the notion that we're geniuses. You know, I think that there are ways in which perhaps, and I'm saying perhaps, folks who are ultimately selected for these prizes are incredibly focused, are incredibly curious, are willing to sort of shift the paradigms of their work so they begin to see the world somewhat differently than their colleagues in their fields do, and are willing to go with that and risk that. But, you know, these folks I haven't studied, I just feel a little bit embarrassed talking about it. I don't know. I don't know how that would match on to the.
It would eliminate the problem of healthcare, because no, I'm actually serious, because it's such a large grant.
Yes.
You know, so the people who do have this creative energy and who do have all these impulses to do so many things, but who have been tethered by economic necessity to keep working or to get healthcare, don't have that. Right. So wouldn't that just be one more thing that would produce some freedom for people who are already kind of...
Well, I think that one of the things that I thought you were asking, how are they different when they're chosen, why, that sort of thing. I think that one of the things that happens when you are chosen is that you are given this incredible abundance and space and time to be creative in. And there's a way in which it offers a sort of a validation of the work that you've done. And that's just, it's just a lovely situation to be in.
This, fine.
Speaking of the generational cohort that this third chapter is, how does it affect the other chapters, the people coming up? Because I'm also thinking that this chapter 3 is still being pushed from behind by chapter 2 and technology and all the work that's coming up. So as this huge 40% workforce is changing in the baby boom generation, did any of these people talk about how they as a group or what they're experiencing is affecting what's ahead of them and what's behind them and the lives that are following them. I'm not sure if, how is this relationship, as this chapter changes, as we're moving into this chapter of 51 and 75, who are finding their voices mm-hmm. because they've been caught in the second chapter as a group voice, and all of a sudden they're released into an individual voice. How does that then affect the other chapters in relationship?
I was with you until you sort of said individual and group voice. Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
The story, these people are, it seems to be they're passing in the third chapter. The man had found his own voice. He wanted to sing. He wasn't able to sing, so he took another job. The lawyer was part of a partnership. He left that behind to become an individual to pursue gardening, his own.
But then he joined another community, right? As a matter of fact, he would have said to you, as he said to me, I finally feel as if I'm part of a community. That is, his work, giving forward, planting gardens in Boston, and really made him feel as if he was connected very much to other people.
But is that knowledge that he's now gained able to be reflected back and being able to reflect it forward?
Well, I guess one of the things that I've experienced in just going and talking to folks about this third chapter and talking to people who are not yet in it, perhaps even they're in the first chapter and they're as young adults or the second chapter as people in their middle years, is that just being able to sort of anticipate that the third chapter might be one of ascendancy rather than decline is a very, very different orientation and framework to be able to work with. And being able to anticipate that your life in the third chapter, that you can have a life not defined by the work that you do, but by who you are, right? And by other things other than sort of institutionally defined, defined by role or defined by status and station, that there are other ways of defining yourself is, I think, another important lesson that second chapter learners and people might be interested in. It was interesting. The first interview I ever had for this book was with someone from Publishers Weekly. It was an interview. And she was asking me all kinds of questions, and her voice sounded young to me. And at some point, and although she was asking wonderful questions, and I sort of wondered, though, is she getting me? Is she understanding what I'm saying? So finally I said, how old are you? And so she said, 27. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, and she said, this book is so encouraging to me. You know, it lifts my heart. And I said, tell me what you're saying. And she said, just imagining the possibility of continuing to learn, continuing to become, continuing to grow in different ways, in different forms, through relationships, through art, you know, through service. She found very, very compelling and very wonderful.
I want to add to that story.
Yes.
Because I read that interview, mm-hmm. and for me, the punchline of that interview was at the end, after you asked her how old she was, and she said 27, and you said to her, you have a lot to look forward to.
I did.
I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's your message, really, mm-hmm. isn't it? I mean, is his hand up here?
We've touched on the issue of abundance from the examples that you've been citing. It seems like there may be an issue of what we used to call alienated labor, that people, to earn a living, end up doing things that are not really satisfying or become unsatisfying. Do you think that you're seeing a lot of that, or is that just kind of incidental?
Am I seeing a lot of people who have been alienated from their work in the Marxian terms?
Yes.
Yeah. I would say that in my conversations even beyond this book, it's interesting that I have found a lot of people alienated from their work, which is part of the motivation, I think, for people trying to do something new, learn something new, reinvent themselves in the third chapter. And what's fascinating to me is it's from the person who came to fix my dishwasher, the plumber, who says, I don't know, I just needed a new kick in my life, a new edge. You know, he said, why'd you do it? Because I needed something new, right? I needed, he kept on saying, a challenge. And two, people like some of the stories, that whether it's the public health doctor that I talked about working, who you would think isn't alienated from his work, but there is by now some redundancy in it. And he's looking for some passion to come back. And he looks towards home and finds this wound that then allows him to move forward, not only in terms of gaining his own voice, but in terms of his work in Africa. So I think it's the entire range of people, from the folks that you would imagine having a kind of redundant work life to ones that you would imagine having a more adventurous work life. But after a time, it is a life of routine. And it's begging to change in some way. I think it's also true that you can't always tell from the outside what's boring to people, what burns them out. So that there are some teachers, and I've spent a lot of time in schools, who are into their 35th year of teaching kindergarten, and it still sends them, truly. It still sends them the fascination with teaching young children and seeing how they learn and learning alongside them continues to give them a kind of inspiration and motivation to keep on. And so even though it seems like a career that's horizontal, they haven't moved up to become assistant principal or assistant superintendent, you know. They've stayed maybe even in the same room, but their life has continued to be a life of learning and exploration and adventure. From the outside, it might not look like that, but from the inside, it feels like growth and change.
Such a good point. The environment's not changing, but the person in the environment is changing. Yeah. Are there two more questions?
At the beginning, when you started, I said to myself, she's talking about me.
Thank you for saying that.
A couple of years ago, I was, actually more than that, a few years ago, I was injured, and I wasn't supposed to ever walk or talk again, so... my grandchildren, my grandsons in particular, has inspired me to not only to write, but to be creative. My first book, which will be published shortly, is A.B. Can't Cook book, because I can't cook. But my grandson now is my boss. What do you think about the role of grandparents in the life of the children?
Well, you just asked the right person, because I've just become a grandmother. For the first time, and I don't know what the role of grandchildren is, but I'm really trying to redefine my own role as grandmother. I think that both children and grandchildren offer us, we in our third chapters, particularly involved in major comebacks, a kind of support, a kind of cheerleading, a kind of prodding, a kind of youthful enthusiasm and passion that can come from no other place. And there's a way in which when my daughter, Tolani, who's now the mother of my new grandchild, said to my mother, Nana, she said, you're going to live till you're 100. My mother believed her. I'm telling you, she believed her. There's something out of the mouths of babes who love us and who expect us to protect them that feels very powerful in terms of cheering us on. And so I think they serve a very, very important purpose of support and cherishing and cheerleading.
Well, I want to say something about the flip side of that, because in my various interviews with Frank Gehry, he talked a great deal about his grandmother. And it seems that when he was a very little boy, his grandmother had a wood stove, and she would go to all these little shops around the neighborhood, and she would fill burlap bags with like the ends of pieces of wood, things that didn't work for other bigger purposes. And she'd take all these little pieces of wood, they'd go back home to her house, and she would take the burlap bags and fill the floor of the kitchen with these pieces of wood. And the two of them would sit on the floor and make cities.
Yes.
And they would build buildings, and they would build bridges. And later on, when he was choosing what he wanted to do with his life, he remembered sitting on the floor with his grandmother and how that was the most fun he had in his life.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I was just overwhelmed by that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a gorgeous story, and I think that one of the things that grandparents offer in our new freedom, not having to parent.
That's fine. Yeah.
Is play, imagination, is sort of going with the flow, is opening up our hearts to these very, very questioning, inquisitive children's minds and hearts. So it's a wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful way of looking at it, the not parenting.
Right. Right.
There's someone back there.
The 60s, us passionate 60s type you talked about who wanted to change the world back then, went off and had a career and raised a family and so forth. And got kind of jaded along the way, as if it's almost impossible to make the kind of changes we wanted to change, even though a lot of change happened. Did you find a lot of your interviewees kind of gave up trying to do a lot of change and just spend their third chapter enjoying themselves and learning and so forth, but not trying to make a significant contribution back to the community and so forth? Or do you find a balance, or what? What kind of balance do you find?
Well, I think it's a range, but I do think one woman, for example, who had been extremely, now a federal judge, who had been extremely active in the civil rights movement, extremely active in the peace movement and in the women's movement, calls us, third chapter folks, emissaries of the 60s. She thinks that it is our responsibility to lead the way now. Because we've had this tradition, because we've been embedded in this historical period, and we know what it means to make a difference. But the other thing that she recognizes, and a bunch of the other folks that I interviewed recognize, is that change is not likely to be sudden or enormous. In other words, it's likely to be incremental. It's likely to be a bunch of small steps. And so they change their lens in some ways to recognize success in the incremental and small changes, rather than to feel defeated by the fact that those big changes aren't immediately apparent. It is that kind of new perspective taking on their civic engagement, I think, that shifts, even though maybe the passion remains, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to make two thank yous before we conclude here. First, I'm going to thank you last.
Good.
First, okay. Yeah. I want to thank the audience. I want to thank you all for coming. And if you've had a lovely time this evening and you want to see many, many more of these Aloud programs, we hope that you will think about contributing something to the Library Foundation and to the Aloud series. Please help support the library right now. And now, of course, I would like very much to thank you. This was truly wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.